That was my one because I thought, oh.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Tuesday, February 11, 2003. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5011, and we'll ask Greg to come on up, and whoever else Greg is coming with you. And with that, tap of the gavel, we'll be open on that public hearing.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. With me today is going to be Pete DeLuca, but before Pete steps up, I would like to go over a letter that we prepared for you to try to provide additional information based upon the questions that we received yesterday. There's a cover letter with attachments, and the first item that I cover there is that we are contacting those legislators that had questions about constituents with workers' compensation claims. We met with Representative Krieger yesterday. I think that the key for us is that if you see us as a partner and support to you, that's exactly the type of customer service that we want to provide to each of the members to assist in any constituent problems.
Anyone from my office get in touch with you? Because we actually had the person in the building yesterday that I made reference to. Did anyone contact you?
Mr. Chair, no, they didn't. Okay. Did I fail to introduce myself in the very beginning that I'm Greg Malkasian, Deputy Director? Sorry. The second item is we talked about customer satisfaction surveys, and we've attached some examples. A cover letter with some examples is attachment one that outline our process, and we even have a new internet-based survey tool, and it covers that as well. Then there was a question about the dedicated nature of the worker benefit fund, the cents per hour, and also the premium assessment revenues, and there's a letter that outlines the specific dedicated nature of those funds. And then there was a question about workers' compensation coverage, which was really about who is a subject employer and a subject worker, and there is an attachment three, that letter that outlines those coverage exceptions. And then there was a question about workers' compensation insurer performance and complaints against insurers. There's a cover letter that outlines that with some additional information about performance at attachment four. There was a question about benefits related to vocational training, and we've answered that in the body of this letter to the best of our ability. And then finally, there was a question about a worker's right to change physicians, and there's an attachment five that outlines those rights of injured workers. Are there any questions on the letter or the attachment, or we would enjoy an opportunity to visit with you at any point?
We'll inform our membership. Just for the record, Senator Carter had called and said that she would be late this morning, so let everyone know she is trying to get here.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sir Morris, did you have a question?
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, our first presenter will be Pete DeLuca. He's our administrator of the Oregon OSHA.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, member of the committee, I'm Pete DeLuca. I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. The purpose of Oregon OSHA, of course, is to administer the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Our mission is to advance and improve workplace safety and health for all workers in the state of Oregon. OSHA itself is a federal program. It was commenced in 1969 with the passage of the Williams-Steiger Act, which created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And part of that act provides that states can run their own occupational safety and health programs as long as they are at least as effective as the federal governments. And since we have been in this business, we have always been at least as effective as the federal government. We passed the Oregon Safe Employment Act in 1973, and so this is our 30th year anniversary of the passage of that act. The history of Oregon OSHA is a history of partnership, and partnerships are really the key to our success. In our partnerships, everybody comes away with something. Employers save money because safer workplaces lower the cost of doing business, lower the cost of workers' compensation insurance. And you heard Mr. Malkasian reference last Thursday that overall, since the Mahoney Hall reforms in 1990, employers in Oregon had saved $7.5 billion. Most professionals in this area will tell you that those are direct costs, and there are also indirect costs that can be calculated as well. Those indirect costs include things like replacing workers, retraining, the lost productivity, et cetera, and most people will say that that's somewhere in the neighborhood of a multiple of 4 times the direct cost. So I think it's safe to say that since that time, safer workplaces have contributed to at least a $30 billion savings to Oregon employers. Of course, employees get a lot out of this program, too. At the end of the day, they go home in the same condition that they came to work. At least that's our hope, and that's what we work for every single day. So we are engaged in protecting workers as part of our organization goals, dovetailing with the mission of the department and also lowering the cost of doing business, making it a more business-friendly environment here in the state of Oregon. Cooperative efforts are our hallmark. And if you go back to Mahoney Hall, that was really the genesis of the modern Oregon OSHA, where business and labor got together and made compromises to affect the system. One of the compromises that the labor got was an enhanced Oregon OSHA. That cooperation between business and labor extends today. Almost all of our committees are joint committees with representation of both business and labor on the committees. And we often say, in making any kind of a major decision, if it isn't good for business and labor, and if it doesn't work for government, then it's not going to work, and we'll go back to the drawing board and we'll work on it until it does work for all three of those entities, because if it's not going to work for one of them, it's not going to work for any of them. Our funding comes from the workers' comp premium assessment, and we also get 25% of our funding from the federal government. All of these are non-general funds. They're other funds, so we're not asking for any general funds. And I get up every morning and say a little prayer that I don't have to compete with school children for the funding that we ask it for. I'm going to talk a little bit about our programs now. 4 major program areas I want to talk about are consultation, enforcement, training, and our technical assistance program.
What page are you on?
Well, I'm kind of skipping back and forth to give you a big picture. Most of the material is under the Oregon OSHA tab, the OSHA tab in the executive summary, and I'm kind of fleshing out what's already in there.
He keeps us off balance.
Yes, that's right. He keeps us switching pages so he thinks we're not listening. Where are we?
Okay. The first program I want to talk about is consultation. And, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that on Thursday. We have 36 consultants. It is the most active consultation program of any place in the nation. And the purpose is to assist employers. People call us up and they say, we want to know about how to fix this machine, or we want to know about what your requirements are with respect to something, or we want you to come out and do a wall-to-wall assessment. Tell us how to make our business better, and we'll send a consultant out or a team of consultants if need be to that business to work with that business at no cost to that business, and that's our consultation program. Our major program, of course, is enforcement. We are a regulatory organization. We have 80 compliance officers. But in spite of the fact that they're out there in a regulatory mode, we like to say that we believe and we hope that every single experience that a business has in that enforcement mode is going to be a learning experience for that business. When we walk away from the business, we want to say that the experience that the employer had was more positive than negative. And to that end, we measure with compliance officer questionnaires that we send to businesses on a periodic basis to check and see how we're doing, and we have experienced 94% positive ratings on those questionnaires over time. The third program that I want to talk about is training. We had 14 professional trainers on our staff. They conduct 400 training events every year. So on any given workday, Monday through Friday, 52 weeks of the year, someplace in the state we're probably putting on at least two different training events. It's a very active program, and we will train anywhere from two or three or a handful of people all the way up to a whole auditorium full of people. We put on six major conferences a year, and the biggest of those is the Governor's Occupational Safety and Health Conference. That takes place every other year in March. It's going to be next month. You'll all get an invitation to it. This particular conference attracts 3,000 safety and health professionals across the region. 3,000. That's a huge number. And frankly, when I became the administrator of Oregon Ocean and went up to this thing, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. But it's a huge conference. It completely fills the Oregon Convention Center up in Portland. And you're all invited. You'll probably be too busy to come, but in the event that you get an opportunity, come on up and join us for a little while. The last program I want to talk about is our technical program. Our technical program is in charge of writing rules. They also provide interpretations of those rules, and anybody who calls up with a question can speak with someone in the technical section and get technical assistance. General philosophy of Oregon OSHA, we want to assist employers towards self-sufficiency, both in terms of enforcement and consultations. self-sufficiency is very important, and it's a theme that runs through our program these days, because we have 80 compliance officers, and there are 80,000 businesses in the state of Oregon doing business at 120,000 different locations. We can't be in all those workplaces. But the more businesses that are self-sufficient, the less need they have for us to be there. And so that's a primary philosophical goal that we have. Of course, we have a balanced approach. I talked a little bit about the three-legged stool of business and labor and government. In addition to that, part of that balanced approach is that all of our programs work together. People occasionally ask me what's the most important program that we have. And depending upon your perspective, you say, isn't it enforcement or isn't it consultation? My answer is always the same. It's all of them work together. People go to our consultation programs because we have a strong enforcement component. And we couldn't have a strong enforcement component if we didn't have an effective consultation program helping people to understand what their obligations under the law are. And so all of these things fit together, and they work together, and it's a balanced approach. It differs very much from the feds. The feds don't have nearly as much assistance as we do. They also don't have nearly as much enforcement as we do. So they're going to come around a lot less frequently. But when they come, they're going to leave a piece of paper that has a much bigger number on it. We probably have the most penetration in the workplace of any place in the nation. But in return for that, we have the lowest fines. And our philosophy is we don't have to issue huge fines as long as we're out there and around as often as we can be. So those two are kind of trade-offs. If we have less people going out to do enforcement, maybe we'll have to give out bigger fines just to keep people in line. But hopefully they're going to keep themselves in line because we're going to be out there with the people that we've got. Part of our agreement with the federal government involves a strategic plan. This is something that's 5 years old now, but I want to talk about it because it hits the three major goals that our program has that drive just about everything that we do. And the first goal, and I've talked about this before, is employer self-sufficiency. We are dead set on helping people to become self-sufficient in the areas of safety and health. To that end, we have a couple of programs where we measure and give actual awards for self-sufficiency. One is the SHARP program, which is the Safety and Health Achievement and Recognition Program. The other is the Voluntary Protection Plan, which is a national program. And the Voluntary Protection Plan recognizes employers that are truly the best of the best. The SHARP program recognizes employers that are doing a real good job and just below that level. And both of those programs provide for a mechanism where employers can get an exemption from our scheduled inspections if they fall within that criteria. We think, obviously, that if they're doing a good job, they don't need to see us. So we go on to the people who need to see us a little bit more often. The second component of our strategic plan is reduced injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. And that, obviously, is a goal of any occupational safety and health program. You'd expect it. It's here. I don't think it needs a whole lot of elaboration. The third goal is a goal that's important to me because I've been involved with government for about 25 years. You see a confidence ebb and flow, and all too often it ebbs. And we want, as a goal, to leave people with a higher level of confidence, both in Oregon, OSHA, and also in government in general. We feel that oftentimes the only contact people will have with their government is the contact that they have with us. And if they have a positive experience, they're going to think better of all of us in government. And if they have a negative experience, they'll also think worse of all of us in government. To the extent that we can help by making those experiences positive, making them learning experiences, and leaving them with something of value, we improve the image of government as a whole. I'd like to talk about a little bit about some of the major accomplishments of the system. And when I talk about the system, I want you to understand that I'm not saying that Oregon OSHA went out and did each one of these things. We're part of a bigger whole. I mentioned 3,000 safety professionals coming together next month at the GOSH conference. That's the system. Business and labor and government working together, that's the system. But we're a part of that system, and that system in the past several years has achieved some really astonishing results. Fatalities. And this is an important statistic to me because, as Senator Dukes was making mention, you can alter the number of people who have access to filing a claim by changing the criteria, but fatalities are kind of hard to alter for obvious reasons. And we have seen, in terms of program-related fatalities, an incredible reduction over 10 years. 65 fatalities that were program-related, that means not heart attacks, not something that occurred off the job or something of that nature, but were actual on-the-job fatalities in 1991, 34 in 2001. That's a 50% reduction, or said another way, in 1991, we killed twice as many people in this state as we did in the year 2001. Now, 2001 may be a bit of an aberration. We expect the number to go up somewhat in 2002, but what we look for is an ever-declining number. And these are raw numbers. These are not rates. These are not rates per thousand. This is a raw number. So we're looking in the face of rising employment. We have reduced fatalities. We look for that continued reduction. As long as the line continues to go down, we think we're headed in the right direction. Injuries, you've heard there's been a significant reduction in injuries over the course of time. In 1990, there were 9 cases per 100 workers. In 2000, 6.2 cases per 100 workers, and that's about a 30% reduction in injuries in Oregon workplaces. And the comp rates, of course, 12 years of successive reductions in workers' compensation rates, which are driven to a large extent by the number of claims that come in, which are also driven to a large extent by the number of people who get injured in the workplace. 12 successive years. There's no other state in the nation that can say that. 12 years in a row.
Chair, mm-hmm. Certainly represent for your...
I would suspect, maybe I'm wrong, that within the forestry field, is pretty severe sometimes as far as the number of... do you have any idea of the 60-some that you had then that took place with mills, log trucks, logging operations? Because from that time to now, you've had a 50% reduction in that total workforce. And that could accommodate for that 50% in one field unless there was some real change of the rate of death within that.
Chair, Senator Krieger, Representative Krieger, we do look at those things. I can't tell you exactly how many logging statistics there were back then as opposed to now. I can tell you this, that logging is a very dangerous industry, but over the course of time, as we have reduced our numbers of people in the woods. We have increased about the same amount, the numbers of people in construction. And construction, statistically speaking, is about equally hazardous to logging. So we've asked ourselves that same question. Is this just due to the fact that people aren't working in the woods? And what we've concluded is no, it's not, because we've had a reduction in one hazardous industry and a similar increase in another hazardous industry, and we think that it pretty well levels itself out. Now, certainly there's a little bit of play in there, and it's impossible for us to tell exactly how much it levels itself out, but we think that, that those two factors counterbalance each other.
I'll follow up. Somewhere you have the figures of how many of those 64 were within what industry? Same field.
Chairman, Representative Krieger, we can certainly do that for you. We'll get it for you tomorrow.
Excuse me, Senator Morris.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
you can. Oh, excuse me. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who monitors the public workplace?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we do. We do monitoring in both the public sector and the private sector in Oregon.
Follow-up question. Looking at your incident rate for 100 workers and thinking about the risk, if your risk rate is that incident rate, the public sector incident rate is equal to, in fact, it's climbing, just a little trend there. On page 4 of your graph, and if you were to risk rate that, it would look, it would appear to me that the public sector is underperforming in terms of safety, the private sector.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I can't disagree with you. That's true. It's always been a little bit different from the private sector. There could be any number of reasons why, but you're right, it is climbing slightly.
I believe that would be something to focus on in terms of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we do some focus on the public sector. One of the things that we've looked at very carefully over the past several years is how do I characterize this? It's not traffic safety or highway safety, but it's highway construction safety, because that's an area where we see lots and lots of problems, both in terms of signage, in terms of the people who use those traffic control signals out on the road being hit and injured and killed, and also in terms of the workers themselves. We look at that. We work carefully with those people and do what we can.
You're referring to ODOT or the private sector?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, primarily I'm referring to ODOT. There's a committee that we have which encompasses all of those professions, and we work with that committee as well.
No question, if you're out on that road today, there's a tremendous disrespect for the employees that are out there trying to work on a highway. You see it constantly. Question relative to Representative Krieger's question, though, and that is, I've seen a significant improvement in the safety equipment that's on modern logging equipment. And I would think that there has been a corresponding reduction in accident rates. You know, we were talking, Senator Duke yesterday mentioned chokers, you know, the choker center. Today you watch a modern logging outfit, and you may not even have anyone doing that, and you're harvesting smaller trees, which mean a lot of hydraulics, fully enclosed cabs, seat belts are being worn. And, you know, you watch a modern operation and you think, boy, that is completely different than the way we used to do it. And that's why I bend over a little bit when I walk. It's from one of those accidents. So, you know, I just see tremendous improvement. Is there any way to measure that? In other words, the quantity of wood products that are being moved for number of employees and yet the ratio, in other words, so many board feet equals so many accidents, anything like that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can go back and ask that question. We keep statistics on so many things that it would make your head spin. Certainly, you know, in response to what you've said, not only are there less people in the woods, the way things are being done are so different today. I mean, you can go into a sawmill, and there's nobody there. It's all automated. So there's nobody to get hurt. You can go to the woods, and instead of having fellers and choker setters, you've got somebody in a great big machine that chops them and limbs them and takes them and stacks them. And there's no way that person's going to get out of that machine and get hurt unless something happens to the machine itself. So, I mean, obviously there are lots and lots of changes, technological changes and other changes that have impacted this activity. And whether we can measure by which change had how much impact, I think, you know, a lot of what we do is kind of an all things considered business. And you can't really point to any one particular thing, but clearly there are less people in the woods, and clearly working in the woods is safer today. What we see, though, what we continue to see, are the same old accidents that you're probably familiar with. People who are not far away enough when they break out a turn of logs and something kicks loose and injures them. People who, they still ride the rigging. You know, as many times, and I don't know, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, it means you put your foot in the choker stirrup and you ride up to the log deck, and it's incredibly dangerous, because if anything goes wrong, that cable starts to bounce, it'll knock you right off of there, and then how far are you going to fall and into a whole bunch of stumps and logs and things like that, and people get hurt doing that kind of thing. There are still accidents in the woods, and you know, the log trucks still roll over and logs fall off and roll over people, and people are crushed, and we still see a lot of the same old kinds of things, but we also see a lot less of it, and part of that is because of the technology.
Ken Krieger.
The workforce I see changing, because I'm familiar with that industry, and you do not have the depth of the people that are woods wise, that grew up with it and understood it and saw the technical changes of the old way to the new way. So you bring someone in, I'm willing to bet you, if you could check your stats, that first 2 years is worth those accidents are happening with those new people before they really learn what they're doing out there.
Chair Representative Krieger, that's absolutely true, and it's true in any industry. I think somebody mentioned yesterday that most of the accidents, the testimony I heard yesterday was people who were older were wiser about keeping themselves safe. We find that there's an exponential increase in the potential for injury when people are new on the job during the first few months and during the first couple of years. And then as they get more savvy about whatever it is, whether it's in a factory or the woods or wherever, their potential for accidents goes down.
An old pilot and a bolder pilot.
That's right. Well, that brings me to our budget request. Our budget request continues current programs. We are asking for no new positions. We are asking for no packages. The bottom line total of the budget request is just shy of $41 million. And again, this is not general funds. It's all other funds. We're asking for the authority from the legislature to spend those funds that have been already set aside through the pure premium fund that we get in CVS, and also the funds that we're going to be getting from the federal government. And what we intend to do in the next 2 years with those funds, 5,000 plus inspections per year, 2,500 consultations per year, lots and lots of training. We'll continue that, and of course we will continue our commitment toward the downward trend of injuries, accidents, and fatalities in Oregon workplaces. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
The one thing that we've really appreciated, and that is the expanded library with available, particularly video games. You know, I've mentioned that several times because I've just found that amazingly effective. to, you know, sit and run down, plug in the video, get a cup of coffee and a cookie. Not too hot a coffee, though. Got to be careful.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in a 15-minute presentation, I didn't mention every single program that we have, but one of our more popular programs is a resource library in the basement of the L&I building that has just a wide variety of videotapes and other materials that people can check out. And you can walk in there and browse, or you can call them up and ask them for subject matter, and they have a good grasp of what tapes are available, and they'll be happy to send them to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that 25% of your funding is federal funds. How is that formula, or how does that occur? Are we required to put a 75% match up, or do you get a fixed amount from the feds, and then Oregon's contribution is what you've worked out between your partners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the way it works is the federal government, in their budget, asks Congress for a certain amount of money that they set aside, and then there's a formula that was worked out several years ago where each state gets a different proportion of the share that federal OSHA has set aside for state programs. Actually, the fact of the matter is 26 states run their own state plans, and I think about 33% of the federal budget is spent on the states. And so they have jurisdiction over the rest of the states, and if I'm not mistaken, the numbers of people in those states, numbers of workers that they cover about 60% of the nation's workforce. And about a third of the money that is set aside for them, they set aside for the states and divide it up. Now, most of those funds are divvied out to the states on the basis of a straight match. So it's a dollar-for-dollar match. What we do every 2 years is we come to the legislature and we ask the legislature for limitation authority to spend as much money as we have in our budget. And then that money we will spend. If we get federal funding, then that just offsets the amount of money that we spend. And the federal budget, because it's A, congressional, and B, written up by the White House, changes from year to year, so we never know exactly how much money we're going to get. But the dollars that we do get are matched 50-50. Now, some states have a program where they only set aside the amount of dollars that the federal government is going to give them. One of the things that came out of Mahonia Hall was an enhanced OSHA program, and a couple of things in particular. We got a whole bunch more consultants from that compromise, and as a result have been able to go out and provide a whole lot more help to Oregon businesses. So our match or our funding isn't a 50-50 simply because the legislature gives us authority to spend more money than that. But the money comes out of that peer premium assessment, and that is an amount that's generally agreed upon by the stakeholders that use this system. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me follow up on that one, and that is, you know, half the states are running their own program, the other half are depending on, you know, federal OSHA. Who comes out ahead dollar-wise? I mean, do the feds spend more on their program than they're giving us as you know, for our operation?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't say that per capita in a given state that the feds spend nearly as much as we do. And I would also say that they probably don't get nearly the bang for the buck that we do. We have consultation, training, and technical assistance, which is beyond what you'll get in a federal state.
My point, and I realize that, but my point was, is that are we disadvantaged as far as the amount that they would spend per employee, per worker in the state, versus what we get to do the same thing and do it better? Because we see that every once in a while in which, you know, for example, some of our funding that comes into Health and Human Services, well, we get less money than other states. Well, why is that? Well, you were very efficient a few years ago. And you think, well, that doesn't make a bit of sense. But we're, with us delivering a superior product, you would think that they would help us additionally. But what I'd like to know is per employee, how much do they spend compared to what we get?
Mr. Chairman, well, I can't tell you how much they spend per employee, but I can tell you this, that in terms of the split with all of the states, I'm going to say this real quietly.
Okay.
Oregon gets a lion's share. And the reason for that is that we have a program that has been recognized since the time that the funding formula was worked out with the feds, that provides more services that helps Oregon workers more than other states. And we were able to argue at that time for a bigger share of the proceeds, and we got them. And to tell you the truth, it was such a bloody fight at the time that nobody's wanted to revisit that funding formula. And as long as they don't, it's in Oregon's best interest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Malkasian, and our next presenter is Joel Ariel, who is our Insurance Division Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Joel Ariel. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel, and I'm the Administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division. I'm going to focus my presentation around three basic questions. First, what is our mission and purpose, sort of essentially why do we exist as an agency? Second, an overview of our programs, how are we performing in carrying out that mission through our three major programs? And then finally, I'll focus on our budget and some of the performance measures that we have for improving our work in the insurance division. I'm going to be referencing the materials under the insurance tab in the in your presentation document, and if you looked at page 3 under the insurance tab, you would find there that our mission is to administer the insurance code for the benefit of the insurance buying public while supporting a positive business climate. Sounds rather similar to most of the other missions in DCBS. It has both the consumer protection dimension and the supporting business dimension to it. The consumer protection side of that actually comes right out of the code. Early in the insurance code, the legislature has given us the instruction that the code is to be, quote, liberally construed for the benefit of the insurance buying public. And we take that approach to our work, always focusing first on the question of, is this good for consumers? Will it benefit consumers? Consumer protection mandate that we have has been the fundamental goal of insurance regulation for more than a decade now. We've traced back the insurance code to at least 1891, is the first version of it that we found, and we think it may go back even earlier than that. But so it's a longstanding consumer protection activity of the state of Oregon. And finally, I want to say that just as the director did to reinforce that the two parts of our mission, consumer protection and promoting a positive business climate, we consider to be mutually reinforcing. There is probably nothing worse for a consumer in Oregon to have a situation where there is either no insurance available to them or their company has gone insolvent. So promoting a positive business climate is absolutely critical to achieving our consumer protection mission. If we look more specifically at the purposes that we have to achieve our mission, and this is still on page 3 of the materials up at the top. Is it page 2?
Page 2.
I'm sorry, yep. Page 2 of the materials. There are three basic purposes there. One is the financial, ensuring the financial soundness of insurers. Secondly, the fair treatment of consumers. And finally, ensuring the affordability and availability of insurance. Let me just talk for a minute on each of those. The financial soundness of insurers, again, our top consumer protection priority. Again, there's probably nothing that causes more problems for consumers than to have paid a lot of money into an insurance company, and then when it comes time for that company to honor its promises in the insurance contract, it doesn't have the resources to do so. It's particularly important in the insurance business because the nature of that business is that those promises can be very long-term, life insurance till death, and many of the other promises go on for many decades. And so there are fairly complicated rules in insurance about how companies need to reserve and ensure that they have enough money available to pay claims, and we monitor that situation quite closely. Fair treatment of consumers. Consumer security depends on being able to count on the promises. If you've got a health contract, you think it's going to pay for your health insurance, you want to make sure that in the fine print it actually does pay for the health insurance that you thought it was going to pay for. Same thing with auto and homeowner policies and any of the other lines of insurance, and frankly the same thing with many of the business coverages that are available. You have to be able to count on fair treatment, fair application of the contract terms. So we have long had in the insurance code an Unfair Trade Practices Act. We've had an Unfair Claims Settlement Act. And now in sort of recent vintage in the last 20 years, the legislature has added a number of new kinds of consumer protection to the code to ensure fair treatment. A recent example would be patient protection legislation, where there were concerns in the healthcare marketplace that maybe there wasn't as much access as there should be, and the legislature adopted new rules to ensure that there would be reasonable access to the services that were promised. Finally, we have affordability and availability of insurance, and frankly, this is the area that probably is the most challenging for us. In a way, the insurance industry has been victim of its own success here because it's been so good at quantifying risk and spreading risk and making insurance available that people kind of expect there to be insurance in all the different kinds of ways that they would like to have insurance, and that's important, particularly in the basic lines of insurance. In this state, auto insurance, as it is in most states, is a mandatory coverage, so it's simply we have to make sure that there's auto insurance available. For homeowners, it's not mandatory, but if you have a mortgage, your bank will make it mandatory. And health insurance is somewhere between a desired product and a right, depending on who you talk to across the political spectrum. So those are coverages that have to be available, and it's an important part of our job to try to make sure that they are available at an affordable price. In all three of those markets that I just discussed, we have what we call residual market mechanisms, meaning that if there isn't a private insurer available, say in health, then there's the OMIP high-risk pool available, and you'll hear later from the OMIP director on that. In auto and homeowner, there also are those same kinds of residual mechanisms. So somebody that can't get insurance, they've had too many claims, or for some other reason are not insurable in the private market, there are mechanisms available where the insurers in the market essentially pool resources in different ways in different markets, but they pool the resources and kind of take care of the folks that can't get insured through the normal private market. There also are those kinds of issues in other commercial markets. Right now we have, as Senator Morris knows, a problem with medical malpractice insurance in this state, and that's another kind of affordability and availability problem that we wrestle with. So, again, affordability and availability, probably the toughest challenge we have, but one of the more important ones, too. Moving to the second part of my presentation, an overview of the programs we have for achieving our mission and purposes. This material is now, and I think I got the pages right this time, pages 3 and 5. The page that has the 2001 to 2003 successes, it isn't the page with output measures. I'm going to be referring to that material in this section. And we have basically three major program areas: financial regulation, market regulation, and consumer services. In the first area of financial regulation, we do a number of things. We first determine the qualifications of insurers to do business here in Oregon. In this current biennium, we've processed 105 applications for new admissions, and 88 of those have been admitted to our market. We always like to see folks coming into the market, helping out with our affordability and availability issues. In grand total, we now have 1,662 admitted carriers here in Oregon. Every one of them has been reviewed both for their financial strength. We look at the financial statements of all these companies before they come in, and also their credentials. We look at the management, the experience of the management, their record in other states, if they're coming from other states, and so forth, before they're admitted here. And that 1,600 number, if you looked at the output measures, you'll see that's relatively constant across the last decade, and it's, if you looked at other states, that's about the number of insurance companies in most states. There are about 5,000 insurance companies in the United States, and typically states have 1,500 or so in their individual markets. Once the company's in the state...
Senator Dukes?
Generally speaking, what happened to the other 17 that applied and weren't given permission?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, there wouldn't be a generally speaking probably there. There'd be a couple main reasons. One is that we have questions about the management. That's an oftentimes an issue, that somebody comes in and they don't have the requisite experience in their management team. Another thing is companies, it's not unheard of for companies to apply before they've really got a business plan together. And so a lot of those companies that didn't get admitted will probably come back because the first time through they couldn't really answer some of the questions that we asked. And so we rarely deny somebody outright. Most of those 17 that didn't come in chose to withdraw because in the dialogue they decided they didn't have quite the answers that they wished they had to some of the questions. I think we probably deny, you know, just a couple a year outright.
Saying, I'm glad you're out there screening.
Once the company's into the marketplace, the next area is that we monitor their financial strength on an ongoing basis. And we have basically two ways of doing that. One is examinations, which by statute we're required to conduct on our domestic insurers at least every 5 years. We try to do them more like every 3 years, particularly if it's a larger company. And then we also have a financial analysis team that looks at these companies on an ongoing basis, generally reviewing quarterly financial statements. Sometimes it's more frequent than that. If there's a company that's particularly troubled, we may be looking at financials on a monthly basis. We're very much helped in this program because since the early 1990s, there's been a financial accreditation program nationally where all states have met certain basic minimums, both in terms of the laws they have to protect against insolvencies and the standards they have within their administrative processes, the staff levels and that sort of thing, the expertise of staff, to ensure that all states will meet minimum qualifications. And then with that minimum floor, the states then rely on each other to each take care of their own domestics. So instead of us having to take care of 1,662 companies on a financial basis, we take care of the 51 companies that are domiciled here in Oregon and essentially rely on our sister states to take care of their domestics in the same kind of way. All but one state has been accredited through that program. Typically, there's one or two states that are out of accreditation for some short period of time. I think there are two out right now, but all but one state has been through the process. Third thing we do on the back end is if we admitted a bad company or a company in its monitoring, we missed something, or oftentimes, the books don't act in these insolvency situations, the books don't accurately reflect what is going on. We end up with a company that's either impaired or insolvent, and then it's our job in the insurance division to manage those situations. I'm proud to report that we haven't had a domestic insolvency since 1991. So keep your fingers crossed. Those are the biggest problems we come to deal with. But we've been very successful in the last decade in terms of managing our domestics. We have about 15 what we call ancillary receiverships, and that means these are receiverships related to insolvencies in other states. Lately, it's been workers' comp insurers, a couple from California, a couple from Pennsylvania, that have caused the biggest problems. And, of course, a lot of companies are multi-state, national in scope, and so those insolvencies then affect Oregon policyholders, and we have an ancillary receivership to protect the interests of the Oregon consumers of those companies from out of state. And then finally, not unimportantly, we collect taxes for the general fund. We collect more than $100 million in insurer taxes each biennium. That's about six times our own budget. None of that money comes to us like all of DCBS or almost all of DCBS. We're an other-funded division. So we collect $100 million and then spend about $16 million of other funds ourselves. Next area is market regulation. You'll see from the numbers here that this is where much of our highest volume work goes on, starting with agent licensing. We license insurance agents and we monitor their compliance with Oregon law, including their continuing education obligations. In the current biennium, we've processed 25,000 and some licenses and approved 3,600 and some continuing education courses. We now have a total of 52,000 plus agents here in Oregon. That's a major increase in the number of insurance agents. It was only 21,000 a decade ago. Occasionally, we also have to revoke licenses of insurers. We've done that 53 times in the last couple years. Typically, that's for misappropriation and misrepresentation. Misappropriation is the legal term for essentially stealing money from policyholders, collecting premium and not passing it on to the insurance company, that sort of thing. And misrepresentation is the legal term for lying to policyholders, misstating what's in a policy or claiming that they placed insurance when they haven't, that sort of thing. There are a lot of those situations. 53 out of 50,000 is a pretty small number, but it's an important part of our work to deal with the misbehaving agents. Secondly, we review policy forms, and that just means insurance contracts in all lines of insurance, and we review rates in key lines of insurance, particularly in health insurance, individual and small group health insurance. We have prior approval on all rates, make sure they're reasonable, meet the code, and then also in personal lines, which means auto and homeowner coverages, we review rates there. It's very high volume work. You see we process 68,000 newer revised policy rates and forms in the current biennium. With that kind of volume, this is very much a priority area for improved efficiency in the department, and you'll see that show up in our performance measures. We are moving to faster processing of filings. We've moved it down to under 30 days for almost all types of filings on average, and we're also working with other states in this area for more coordination on these product reviews. One of the things that the insurers, particularly the national insurers, focus on these days is that their banking and securities brethren, when they want to put a product to market, they go to one federal regulator, and it's into the market if it's approved. When you want to put an insurance product, which these days often, particularly in the life industry, compete with those banking and security products, you got to go to 50 separate states. Insurers call them 50 ports of entry. They all have slightly different rules and so forth. And so that's a major effort in our national association, is to bring more coordination to that process so that the insurers can effectively compete with the banking and security firms as we move into a world in which all of those things kind of mix together as financial services. And then finally, our third major function in market regulation, we monitor market conduct of insurers on an ongoing basis. This is just the same parallel function as we do on the financial side, this time focusing on their treatment of consumers in the marketplace. So we use both targeted examinations, and we have an analysis function on the market side too. We keep blue books that have a lot of data on the key companies, the larger players in the marketplace. And oftentimes in the health line, that's mostly domestics, but in the property and casualty and life insurance lines, that's mostly national companies domiciled elsewhere. In the current biennium, we took 705 administrative actions and penalties totaling $860,000. That's not for us. It goes to the general fund as well. Most of those are relatively small actions. They're just trying to make sure that there's a level playing field and people file things on time and that sort of thing. But there are also, you know, probably a half dozen fines that are in the $25,000 to $50,000 range in that mix of $860,000. As well. The general area of market conduct is another priority area for better cooperation among the states. We don't yet have a market accreditation program, so we don't have a system where we watch our domestics and every other state watches theirs, because it just hasn't been worked out. But it's also more complicated because unlike the financial books, where once somebody looks at them, they're going to be the same everywhere. Market behavior can be different from state to state, and so the issues here are more complicated, and it's a major priority for us to work to better cooperate with other states on shared problems, and also to improve our data analysis function on this side to better target in on the real problems.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. I watched a program, I believe it was on Dateline, on paper review, and when you got through watching that, you thought, oh my goodness sakes, this is just not fair what we were seeing. Have you guys been monitoring that whole issue, and have any opinion as to where that's headed?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we closely monitor the claims handling practices of insurers, and there have been, not sure which one you're referring to, but there have been some stories recently on Dateline about one of the major property and casualty insurers in the marketplace and how they use paper review on auto claims, and there was an even more recent one on a disability carrier and how they use similar kinds of processes to unfairly, or at least it was alleged, unfairly cut off claimants. We take very, when we go out and do market review, the claims handling area is the area that we're most likely going to really focus in on. Sometimes it depends on complaints as to where we target, but we do find some of the kinds of problems. I have to say, when you watch those shows, it's about 50-50. Sometimes, because by their nature, they only cover a couple cases. So sometimes we do go in and find, and in one of those cases recently, we went in and found that, you know, the anecdotes that were told on the show really didn't accurately reflect the general practice. If you handle hundreds of thousands of claims, you're going to have a few issues that don't work out right. And that was the case in one. In the other one, that wasn't the case. They put their finger right on a serious problem, and there's a particular company. I'm not at liberty to discuss in the cases that are under investigation or examination currently, but there is one of the companies that's taking a bit of heat. And this is one of those coordinated exams. Rather than 50 states trying to do their own thing with a big national carrier, there's a coordinated process going on with one of those companies to address some of those issues.
If we had constituents who felt that, you know, I'm sorry, review of my claim, my diagnosis, or whatever, was not solid, would you encourage them to contact your office and give you the details? I see some heads nodding yes. Give you the details on that, because, you know, a lot of times they're just trusting the people that are there to do the right thing, and it's only maybe a certain period down the time when they find out that, well, that doesn't appear to be the case relative to the review and the payment that was made. And I thought the Dateline did a pretty good job of pointing out that folks, I paid my premiums believing I was covered. I have a legitimate claim and expect to be compensated for it. So, but you would encourage them if someone felt that they'd been treated that way to at least bring you up to date on their concern.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for moving me to the next piece of my presentation, which is about exactly the issue you're talking about, consumer services. And the answer is absolutely yes. We encourage people to come to us with their complaints. Most people don't pay a lot of attention to their insurance contract until they have a claim, and then they still don't really understand it very well when they read it, and so if they don't think they're getting fair treatment, we strongly encourage them to come to us, because we do know how to read those contracts and determine whether there is coverage or not coverage and that sort of thing. In our consumer services unit, the primary purpose of that unit is to help resolve consumer inquiries and complaints. In the current biennium, some 41,000 Oregonians have called us with an inquiry about their insurance, and 9,700 of them have turned into consumer complaints. And by consumer complaint, we mean that the problem they ask us about is serious enough that we say, gee, we can't really answer that question over the phone. We're going to have to take your material, contact the insurance company, and by statute, the insurance company is then obligated to respond to us on behalf of the consumer within 30 days. We analyze that response and then determine whether there's been a problem and help the consumer resolve their situation. And typically, in somewhere over half of the cases, the result is something that the consumer gets some form of relief. Not necessarily everything they hoped for, but they get some form of relief by having contacted our office. And so that's an absolutely critical part of our operation. It not only works to help individual Oregonians, but it also gives us a very important eye into the marketplace. If we get, you know, 5 or 10 complaints in a particular area in a short period of time, then that's likely to go over to our market analysis folks, and you know, they just may have somebody visiting to see, look at a larger sample of their files and see whether this problem is more rampant. Because I think we wish we had the word out better, but I mostly, if I'm around and I meet somebody and they say they have an insurance problem, and I say we've called our office, they don't know about that service, and we do what we can to sort of publicize that.
You know, yesterday we had a little conversation there the other day about one of my constituents, you know, and the problems he was having, the frustration of it.
Right.
The agency was in my office at 4 in the afternoon for 45 minutes. So if I could get the insurance company to be as responsive to the constituent as the agency's been, we'd be making some progress. So not saying we're going to work it out, but at least they were there to try to explain the process and what he may need to do.
I'm just curious. Are you seeing insurance packages with, I guess, a lower percentage of coverage as costs are going up? Saw a program the other day about, you know, this child who suddenly had hit the maximum on health insurance benefits. And there are procedures today that were not around before, and they are very costly. The transplants, the chemo, a lot of the diseases that we can manage but we can't cure, that go on and on. Same thing with automobile insurance. My son had a company for a while that when somebody rear-ended him, he was told that he was only going to get this much because to do more would make the car I guess they repaired it, and then they said the car was more valuable now repaired than it had been when they got it. Well, yeah, that was the point. and so, therefore, they were subtracting a certain amount from it, and I thought, you know, you can't get a car fixed for what it used to be a bumper cost with the front end used to cost. So I just wonder if we're getting policies that are, as you said, people don't know how to read those things. They give them a lower percentage of coverage than they used to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, that's a very clear trend in the health insurance marketplace. The government can't really regulate access to care. I mean, and HMOs, when they tried to regulate access to care, created a backlash. And so the insurers are increasingly relying on higher deductibles and higher cost sharing as a way to try to control costs. We try to put some limitations on that. We try to at all times make it clear that the policy has to be clear to the consumer on those sorts of things. But I think it probably is an important part of an overall strategy of containing health care to allow for some kind of increase in those sorts of cost-sharing parts of the health care premium. It's not as prevalent in auto insurance and in homeowner insurance, although these days I just raised my deductible on my homeowner insurance policy, and it is a way to save money. And in general, those policies are probably better used if they're saved for larger claims. And so some of that is happening in those marketplaces too. But in general, in the auto and homeowner marketplaces, the insurers have a range of options for the consumers, and really they still do in health too. It's unlikely that you're going to see a health insurer who says the only kind of policy I'll sell you is a high deductible, but they may tell you increasingly that, you know, if you want to buy, I know Senator Morse, you've been interested in medical savings accounts. If you want to buy a $2,000 deductible, we'll save you a lot of money on the premium. If you want to buy a full coverage, we'll have it available, but it'll cost you more. So it's more of a market kind of transaction like that's how it's dealt with.
I take it we're not getting anywhere near that line that says affordability for most Oregonians is a policy that really doesn't do them much good.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, I don't think we're, in healthcare, I don't think we're near that point for the average Oregonian. We certainly are near that point for people on the low-income end of the scale, and it's a constant focus of ours to try to figure out how best to maintain affordable packages in the marketplace. And frankly, the more we can succeed in working, and it's not, I mean, again, Pete said, you know, we talk about these things as if we're doing them, but it's us in conjunction with a lot of market forces that make these things happen. But the more we keep the private market healthy and vibrant, the fewer stresses and strains there are on the OMAP high risk pool or on the OMAP Medicaid Oregon Health Plan program. So it's a delicate trade-off, and one interesting thing is there's been a lot of interest in this building for the last several sessions on really stripped-down health plans. Not the MSA route as much, but the notion of cutting out a lot of benefits and just having a minimal benefit package. The problem with that theory is people kind of respond in the nature of your question in the marketplace by not buying it. If you're going to buy insurance, you kind of want at least something that covers, you know, most of the basic types of things that might go wrong. And what's the point of, you can pay $100 instead of $500 a month, but get something that doesn't cover very many things that's not very useful to you. So with those, the really stripped down benefit packages And I'm separating MSAs from this because I think that's a separate issue. And they haven't really been actively marketed, but the other kinds of stripped-down benefit packages have not tended to sell in the marketplace yet. Okay.
Senator Morris?
I have a question regarding numbers.
Okay.
The 0103 legislative approved budget was 14.9 million. At the end of this budget period, apparently it's going to be totaling somewhere around 16.4. If I'm reading correct, this page 7. Will we get into this at a different point in the presentation? If we will, I'll just wait, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that question right now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris. The reason for the big increase is it's under the base budget adjustments, and you'll see this same item under all program units. These is the net cost of the 2001-2003 position actions. You know that there was an increase in pay for state employees, compensation for state employees between 2001-2003, and also there are a number of administrative actions, permanent financing issues that take place. So that is $1.3 million of the increases because of that. So, and there's a small increase for 0305 merit increases, $188,000 that is going to come out of the budget. And another reason for the increase is the inflation factor. Now, I know LFO is looking into removing all inflation factors. So those are the main reasons for the increase from the 14.9 to 16.6.
Follow-up question?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
What would we expect then in the 0305? Will we be looking at base budget adjustments again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, there are base budget adjustments every time because of rule of costs and other issues that come up. But the way things are going right now, like no salary increases for 0305, you may not be seeing this bigger number.
I guess just a rhetorical question is, how is a budget then? If we continually have to make budget adjustments without knowing at this point in time in our budgeting process what those are. It's kind of a philosophical question, I guess, or maybe lack of knowledge of previous processes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the $1.3 million that you see in this budget, and if you walk through all of the others, you'll see a similar kind of adjustment, was budgeted for the 0103 biennium, but it was budgeted centrally and didn't occur when we created the 0103 budget for each agency. And it was special session 3, I believe, where that salary adjustment was distributed. And so that's one of the reasons that you see this high roll-up cost, was because it didn't get factored in when we built the budget at the agency level. You're looking a little confused. Let me see
no,
if I
I'm,
can...
I'm, no, I think I... Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I think I have the clear picture. It just doesn't make sense. A budget, we should set a budget, and that budget should run for 2 years and anticipate whatever those costs will be.
It was a legislative decision to budget the merit, I mean, the cost of living adjustment increases centrally.
And that was in a central fund, and then it
correct.
Just gets distributed.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator,
excuse me, I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to enjoy serving on the emergency board with you. I think they do way too much stuff they shouldn't be doing, so we're going to have a good time.
Was that it?
That was
oh,
it.
Okay.
That's in here, too.
In this case, this agency didn't have
no,
any.
No, they didn't. But
mm-hmm. Right.
As we see these things, often the emergency board has shelled out money.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
Just $100 million amongst friends. excuse me. Rose, had your hands up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Get below the $200 million amongst friends concept down to... could you give me an explanation of the reason for the $2 million plus increase in the ending balance. Why is that occurring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, my name is Greg Malkasian. We discussed generally, and I think in yesterday's materials that we provided, there was a financial report that outlined the methodology and the policy decisions that are made, as well as the legislatively mandated requirements for maintaining an ending fund balance. And so we manage this fund balance quite the same way that Representative Smith was discussing yesterday, is to keep it at that minimum amount necessary to fund, I believe, two quarters. We have not had a chance to adjust the revenue since the governor budget reductions. And so that will be a factor into our calculation of what that ending balance will be next time. And we'll adjust that rate when we know what that final expenditure limitation is going to be. And there's also a fee package to balance the amount paid by insurance companies versus agents. And we'll talk about that tomorrow in the fee bill discussion. But our intent is to manage this at a fairly constant level. Thank you.
Okay, very much appreciate the budget assistance here on those questions. I'm now to the third part of my presentation, which is the budget overview. It's going to be more like the 10,000 foot level for me. If you have more technical questions, feel free on those too, though. We have a $16.6 million budget request. It's essentially a status quo budget. The 93 FTE that we're asking for is a little less than we had in the last biennium. If you looked at our staffing history over the last decade, you'd see that we've basically maintained a staffing level in the mid-90s for the last 10 years. During that period, the premium volume from the insurance industry has grown from some $6.8 billion to $10.8 billion. So premium's up. The industry is about 60% larger, but we've been able to do it with level staffing. Our funding sources are on page 9 here. The primary funding sources that we have, again, it's all other funds, no general funds, are licensing fees and service charges on companies and agents. That's 49% of our budget. Insurance premium assessments, these are separate now from the pure premium assessments that we talked about with workers' comp in the last few days, but these are specific insurance premium assessments. They're about 30% of our budget. And then company examination fees. We go out in the field and audit companies. The fees on that account for about 12% of our budget. Those are the main funding sources for us. And all of these funding sources are recalibrated on a regular basis, usually annually, to ensure that all the fees and assessments accurately reflect program costs, with companies and agents paying based on their share of resources used to regulate and serve them. So, for instance, the one policy package you see from us that has to do with the fee increase on the company side, that was because that in that recalibration we saw that agents were actually paying a little bit disproportionate to their share of the resources. The cost we had in agent licensing and so forth were a little less than what they were paying, and the companies were taking a little more of our resources, so then we tweak that fee to make the fees come fair for everybody. So that's the system we've had for about 15 years, and it's been quite successful for us and is well supported by the stakeholders. Finally, in terms of performance measures, I'm going to quickly run through these by going back to my three program areas, financial regulation, market regulation, and consumer services. And these are on is that my first page number wrong? I'm checking them all now. It's page 4, the performance measures. You'll see that they're in three broad areas, as with all the DCBS goals: protecting consumers, supporting a positive business climate, and providing excellent customer service. On the financial regulation side, which is about a quarter of our budget, goes into financial regulation, the goals are to meet strict timelines for processing company admissions. This was a problem back in the mid-90s. It was taking us a long time to get through some of these company admissions. We have almost all of them under 60 days. now and have some very specific goals there. We also have a streamlined electronic filing option now that works not only with Oregon but in conjunction with other states. Our other most important goals in this area are to identify and address the financial problems as they arise and continue our goal of avoiding any domestic insolvencies here in Oregon. And then finally, make sure that we protect Oregon consumers in the case of foreign insolvencies. And again, that's particularly an issue with workers' comp these days. In market regulation, that's a little over half of our overall budget. Remember, that's area that has most of our real high-volume work with agent licensing and rates and forms. In that area, our goals are to, again, meet strict timelines for processing rate and form filings, a 30-day timeline there, and agent licensing applications. That's about a 30-day timeline as well. And again, we have electronic filing options now. A few years ago, if you were an insurance agent, you wanted to be insured, you wanted to be licensed in 5 or 6 or even all 50 states, which some of them do, it would be a very complicated process of going state by state. Today, you can go to a national clearinghouse, file your material once. If you can answer no to the questions about misconduct, you haven't had any felonies on your record, you've never had any disciplinary action by a state insurance department, your application is going to be automatically, electronically processed, and it's going to be delivered to every state where you want to be licensed in a batch form the next morning, and your process is done. Now, if you answer yes to some of those questions, then it's going to go back to all the individual states, and they're, again, going to make judgments about whether your violations are serious enough to keep you out of a particular state market. So we reserve the ability to control who comes and goes from our market. But if you have a clean record, you've got a nice, simple process now. And that's been a major goal of insurance agents nationwide, and I'm proud to say it's been, you know, achieved now. The other goals in that area are to implement a customer satisfaction survey for the agents we serve. You know, test out whether they're as happy as we think they are. And then finally, we want to continue to improve our ability to target our enforcement resources on the most serious problems in our marketplace. Finally, in the third area, consumer services, which is about 20% of our proposed budget, we assist individual consumers with complaints against their company or agents and want to get relief for as many of them as we can. We continue to assist seniors with their Medicare concerns. We're going to implement a customer satisfaction survey for this constituency. Two, you see this customer service theme running throughout these three areas. And finally, we will maintain a full array of consumer educational materials on our webpage. If you go to our webpage, you can find a brochure or some educational material on basically any line of insurance up there. Most of that stuff is also printed in hard copy. And then final point on performance measures, we have a couple of general ones that relate mostly to business climate. They also relate to customer service, and that is we do all of our work by involving as broad a range of stakeholders as we can find that would care about the issue. So we develop our rules with full stakeholder development through advisory committee processes. The examples from the last biennium would be a prompt pay law that the legislature passed. We had to put the doctors and the insurers in the same room and come up with consensus regulations. We accomplished that. Credit scoring, very contentious issue. I don't think we're I'm talking to Senator Hannon yesterday afternoon. I don't think we're quite done with the issue yet, but we did bring everybody together in a room, and what we could accomplish administratively has been accomplished. So we have a good baseline of protections now in the credit scoring area. The remaining questions about whether it's, you know, ultimately quote-unquote fair to the consumer, we're happy to leave to the legislative branch to decide, but we've sort of cleaned out a lot of the simple issues about disclosure and so forth through that kind of process. And then finally, reasonable enforcement practices. We do have to revoke licenses occasionally. We have to fine companies occasionally. But we try to do as much of that through a negotiation process as possible. So we have a goal of negotiated stipulations rather than hearings and more protracted litigation on those kinds of issues. And we generally focus our enforcement efforts around corrective action, getting the problem corrected more than we do a punitive kind of orientation. That would conclude my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions before we go to Satish.
I'm looking at your internet survey, the MCO survey 2002.
Okay.
And then I glance at some of the others that the percentages of questions were kind of normal. And you see in here where there's 10%, 11%, 41%, 56% dissatisfied or concerned, or one in here has to do with amount of pain. Is there pain worse or more? You know, 94 are the highest number of worse. That was on, I guess stage 4 or 5. When you get all this, what do you do with it? I mean, how do you get that back into the system so that the changes are made?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, my name is Greg Malkasian, and this actually is a survey that was conducted in support of the interest of getting that information for the Workers' Compensation Division, and we could have John respond to that. I haven't found exactly the survey, but would you be available? If we could maybe have John provide it. Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division. And I want to make sure I understand your question. Representative, I believe you were asking what do we do with this information when we obtain it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah, you get the information, you've got it, and it shows that, for instance, on 405, talking about level of pain, physical pain, it's worse, 94%. And then you go back to some of the other questions about whether you're satisfied with this and very dissatisfied. Not saying that you can satisfy everybody, but what do you do with the information as far as bringing it back into the system, trying to improve those numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, what we did with this survey is, first of all, we reported the results on this survey to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. We also published these surveys on our website to try to make sure that people are aware of the results. The policy questions about what can be done in terms of improving these results are often discussions that do occur at the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. In this particular case, this year we have not had a discussion in regard to the managed care organization survey because this is a very recently completed survey for us. In general, our goal would be to improve the performance on that is reflected in regard to the respondents' experience on these surveys. We look at these things and put them into. I talked a little bit yesterday about issues being of high importance and then identifying those areas where there's low satisfaction. And we look at those as opportunities to do some process improvement and try to get our stakeholders together, much like Joel was just talking about, and try to make some improvements in terms of the results. But we don't approach that from we're government and we know best. We don't walk into the room saying we have the solutions. We typically want to get the physicians, the MCO, people together, employer representatives, worker representatives, and it can be as straightforward as starting with brainstorming in terms of who's got some ideas and have some discussion about that. What can we do to improve these results?
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of throw this question out perhaps to Rob and to you folks. I guess I need some help here to assure myself that we're not overcharging on our fees. When I go back and I look at the Legislative Fiscal Office review, the write-up.
Excuse me, which division are you looking at?
The insurance.
Oh, thank you.
The other funds increase has gone from 12 million, 13 million to 16.6. about a 25% increase. But then when I go to the budget environment and I read through this information, it talks about that the significant workload factors are a major issue. Information technology is an issue. The need for education and compliance services. But then I go up and I look at the FTE, and I actually see that FTE has not increased at all. And so what I'm struggling with is, in the course of 3-4 years, we've grown the budget 25%. We're adding to the ending balance, by $2.4 million. And yet our staffing requirements are remaining the same. And I don't see anything in the budget environment that would tell me why we need this additional money. So I'm struggling with
this. I would point out in the governor's budget that we summarized that there was $1.5 million in net base adjustments for salary and workload in the 103 biennium. Most of that is the $1.3 million in salary adjustment.
I guess I'm still struggling, Mr. Chair. And again, this is a new budget to me. Even with the adjustment in salary, the budget has grown from 13 to 16.6, and I don't see where the additional dollars, other than an ending balance, where this is going. And so my concern is are we charging fees that are in excess of what the need is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, the $13 million you're talking about is the 9901 actuals. And so you are looking across three biennia?
Right.
The legislatively approved budget for 01-03 was $14.9 million. So when the legislature approved the budget last for this biennium, there may have been some packages then. Do we remember if we had any packages for this current biennium? For 01-03, I think there was a small package. But for this biennium, the increase is not that much, because if we look at the 01-03 legislatively adopted budget, that's the budget that was approved by the legislature last biennium for the current biennium. That was $14.9 million, okay? And that's what you see under the ledge adopted?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, in my analysis, there was policy option packages in 0103 of almost $800,000. So that's part of the increase between 1999-01 and 0103.
Mr. Chair, I guess my observation is that the trend is the demand for revenue is going like this, and yet our employee is this. And other than what I'm reading in here, funding for education and compliance services and some information technology, I'm not sure why the need for revenue needs to be like this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe it might be helpful for you to refer to the same numbers on insurance, page 7. And that was the information that Satish presented. And it gives a real detailed breakout of exactly where that trend is. And Satish had gone over those. Would you like to go over? And that will help you to target in exactly where that money was. I'll let Satish detail that again.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Smith, and also I want to clarify what I told Senator Morse earlier. If we go to that page, let me go to that. Okay, the starting point, okay, let me just walk you through how this budget was developed, and that means throw some clarity into this. The starting point for this budget development was the 01-03 legislatively adopted budget that the legislature adopted for going home last session. That was $14.9 million. This division did not go to have any emergency board actions. So there's nothing under there. But you'll see that the biggest increase is under base budget adjustments. and that also under net cost of 0103 position actions. How we come up with this $1.3 million is there's a system called the Position Information Control System. It's a central system. So the system comes up with the numbers that needs to be there. Basically, the system comes up with the cost of positions for 0103. Then it comes up with the cost of positions for 0305. So the difference is put in there. And there are a number of reasons why this has increased. And you will be seeing this increase in every budget. One is because of the compensation increases.
Mr. Chair, can you spend a little bit of time going through what those increases are for, what the justification is for those? Give me the global perspective, if
sure.
you will.
The increases, and again, this you'll be seeing in every budget, is there was like a 2 and a 3% increase in COLAs for this biennium. So what
Chair.
We do is, again, on this, we look at the cost of positions. Okay, if there's one position in the budget right now, how much would that the cost of that position be in 03 or 05? The roll-up costs for positions. And with that, then you also have the other compensation issues like PERS, you know, so all of the compensation issues, that's the reason for this increase. And so these are for existing positions. They are not asking for any new positions. So what we can do is, maybe I can bring you something in writing to explain how that calculation is done. That may be helpful for you all.
I think that would be helpful because this same issue will occur in every budget that
every
you
budget.
See.
Uh-huh.
Just my observation, Mr. Chair. Granted, this is not general fund money, but you know, when I read through this and I do see the trend, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I don't understand, but I see a trend, and then I look at the need for merit pay increases and additional money going into these salaries in this time when the governor has stepped up to the plate and has reduced his salary, and the legislature in the third special session reduced its salary. Whether this is a tax or a fee or whatever we want to call it, the fact of the matter is this is money coming out of the taxpayers' pockets. And so I appreciate that. And I think the full ways and means committee, which we're all part of, needs to have that discussion as well about this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two issues here. One is what's already occurred, and that's the $1.3 million. The other is what would have occurred without the action that the co-chairs have recommended that we take, and that is the $188,163, which would be the any merit increases for the next biennium. That is coming out of this budget and every budget. So there will be no money for merit, and then of course the decision has already been made that there will be no cost of living adjustment, regardless of whether that's done at the agency level or at a central level. There will be no money this biennium for any cost of living adjustment. So that number will stay flat going into the next biennium.
Setting the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions in roughly that same vein. If we take out $188,000 in merit increases from an other funded agency, in effect, all we're doing is lowering the cost of that agency. We're doing absolutely nothing in terms of our general fund crisis that we're having in education and public safety and everything else. So I think before the dust settles, we need to be looking at some form of a way to transfer some savings into the general fund. The other question is on your if you could walk me through the insurance taxes, the $109 million that you collect. Kind of give me a little bit of the genesis of that. I'm new to this area of state activity. I'm assuming that's collected because of some type of like an interstate compact. And why are you collecting it instead of the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, the lion's share of that, more than $100 million of the $109 million, is collected through what we call retaliatory taxes. And the history on this is that Oregon, up until 1995, had something called the premium tax, which is a common form of taxation of insurers. Typically, it goes to the general fund rather than to the insurance departments for their own funding. The Oregon system is common across the country. In 1995, the legislature eliminated the premium tax per se, but kept most of the same tax collection mechanisms in place by simply having a retaliatory tax. And what that means is that each of the foreign companies that comes into Oregon now pays taxes, not because we have a premium tax of, say, 2%, that's around the average, but they pay based on what their home state has as a premium tax. So if California has a 2.25% premium tax, California companies pay 2.25%, and across the country in that same sort of way. So most of this money is collected on that basis. There are some excise taxes and some other taxes in there too. I believe those are in that 109, Greg. I'm not sure of that, but the basic problem, more than 100 million of it is in that retaliatory form of tax, which is just a gross tax on premium receipts. Doesn't have to do with profitability. Just if you did $100 million of business, it's a 2% tax, you owe $20,000.
The reason you collect that instead of Department of Revenue is just because of the your expertise and involvement in the insurance industry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that is correct. We had to put on a couple people with that retaliatory tax to keep track of the tax mechanisms in all the different states. The retaliatory tax business gets fairly complicated, and we have two people to just track that. And to, as you might guess, the companies aren't particularly eager to let us know about all the changes that go on in these other states. We have to keep track of that ourselves and make sure that they're paying their fair share under the retaliatory tax.
The interest income of a little over $1 million. One, is that the float? I'm on page 10 of whatever little book it is.
It's their executive summary.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, Greg Malocasian again. That's interest on the ending balance. And that we benefit from, and that ultimately goes to benefit the ratepayers or the those that pay the assessments by reducing the assessment rate as it relates to keeping that ending fund balance level. That I can go back to that same report we gave you on Monday, the financial report that outlines how all those dynamics work. But we do have an ending fund balance. We earn interest off those funds. Those funds go into revenues and balance out with our expenditures.
2 years, you're anticipating 25% return of interest on your on a $4 million ending balance?
The ending balance is not the actual balance that's in the account during the course of the biennium. We'll have revenues that come in during peak revenue receipt times, so our balance will be much higher at a certain time, and so we're earning interest on those funds. So this is more an overall interest based upon all the revenues that come through the fund.
But it's not on the $110 million that you're collecting on the retaliatory tax.
Yes, that money actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that money actually comes in to our account and I believe is transferred out quarterly. And so while it's in our account, we get the benefit of the interest earnings on that money. And those go to the general fund.
The general funds would be increased if the general fund would be increased if that went directly to Department of Revenue and then was invested.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that the interest revenue on that money that flows in that will go to the general fund accrues to the general fund as well. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, if I could just add a general comment that may help understand this. The way our assessment process works is that at the end of the year, that I mentioned three different revenue sources. There's the fees and charges to the various agents and companies, and there's the exam fees. Those are sort of set ahead of time. The premium assessment is kind of a catch-all mechanism at the end of the day to look at how much additional revenue we need to meet our budget for the year, and then the assessment rate is set based on meeting that need. So if in any of these accounts there's more money passing through or less money passing through, in the end of the day that all comes out in the wash in terms of the assessment. It's either going to be a higher assessment on the industry or a lower assessment. So none of these things increase our actual operating budget one way or the other. They simply increase or lower that assessment. And for instance, were the legislature to take some additional money out of these accounts, that would simply increase the assessment of the insurance industry in that category at the end of the day.
Mr. Chair, likewise, if there are reductions in this budget, for example, the merit that would come out, would then factor into the amount of the assessment that they need to charge. So hopefully it will reduce the assessment on the ratepayers.
I just had a senior moment here, and I asked Senator Dukes for help. She said that she was experiencing the same thing.
Mr. Chair, in my own defense,
that was
this
exactly
is a great little agency. We can't get any money out of them, folks. Give it up.
Well, that was my question.
Thank you.
I now know where the $188,000 is going, but I'm still concerned about this. The comment that was made about this interest somehow flowing to the general fund?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Greg Malkasian again. We had referred to the $109 million in insurance taxes above,
right.
And then we referred to the interest income line of $1.1 million. And then down below you'll see the transfer out to the general fund, and that's actually $110.8 million. And that was the discussion that Joel had about our collection of these retaliatory taxes that we collect and they pass through under law to the general fund.
Okay, so that would be, all right, I think I have it. Okay, if not, I'll ask you later, because this is getting
exactly. Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments, Senator Dukes.
Thanks, guys. All right. I'll let you guys determine where we are then, so I seem to be lost at this point.
Mr. Chair, I think we had completed the insurance division. We were ready to move on to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I'm pleased to have Floyd Lanter, our division administrator, here today. Floyd is actually pretty new to our management team. He joined us in May of last year. But he brings a wealth of experience. He was an Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation examiner and head of the Portland field office, and worked with FDIC for 25 years, and we partnered with FDIC, and he'll tell you a little bit about that in our oversight of banks. And so we're real pleased to have his expertise come to the state level. So I'd like to introduce Floyd. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I am the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be here this morning to provide a foundation for the division's proposed budget request for the 2003-05 biennium. I'll briefly cover our mission, our programs, strategic initiatives, a little bit of our division history, our funding, our performance measures, and our budget request. As former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers often said, access to capital and financial services is a passport to our modern economy and key to economic growth. Access to capital helps drive business formation and fuel economic growth, make housing affordable, and let consumers purchase goods conveniently. The Division of Finance and Corporate Securities is a key guardian for that access in Oregon. And our securities and financial services program responsibilities and activities touch the lives of most Oregonians. The mission of our division is to encourage the widest possible range of financial services, products, and information for Oregonians delivered in a safe, sound, and fraud-free manner. To that end, we administer and enforce laws and rules for 15 different programs, the statutory authority for which is found in 24 separate chapters of the Oregon Revised Statutes. These programs govern the following institutions or industries. First is the depository financial institutions. These are our banks, our trusts, savings and loans, and credit unions. The common thread for these institutions is federal deposit insurance. Second are non-depository financial institutions. These are sometimes referred to as fringe banks or non-bank banks. These include mortgage bankers and brokers, consumer finance companies, collection agencies, credit service organizations, debt consolidation agencies, international trade consultants, money transmitters, pawnbrokers, sellers of travel, certificate authorities, and prearranged funeral plans and endowment care cemeteries. Lastly, we have the securities industry. Here we're responsible for the registration and licensing and enforcement of the securities industry in Oregon. The basic description and purpose of these programs, as well as an organizational chart including FTEs, can be found under the Finance and Corporate Securities tab in your executive summary notebook. And I would be happy to discuss specific program activities as the committee desires. In discharging our statutory responsibilities, we strive to ensure that providers make financial products and services available in a straightforward manner, disclosing sufficient characteristics so that consumers can make informed decisions, to provide professional, consistent, and objective program oversight while valuing excellent customer service, to maintain open lines of communication and to be regarded as a resource for consumers and stakeholders, including legislators and licensees. And lastly, we strive to meet performance measures, which you'll find outlined on page 4 of our supporting material, to ensure that the objectives of public policy are met, thereby helping contribute to the department's 3 high-level outcomes, as well as the objectives of Oregon Benchmark number 9, and that is Oregon's national rank in the cost of doing business. The division is comprised of 2 sections, securities and banking, which were combined in 1987 with the creation of the Department of Insurance and Finance. In 1992, the division was reorganized and a single administrator was appointed to oversee both finance and corporate securities. We receive no general fund revenue. We are financed exclusively by assessments and fees from regulated industries. Programs are administered with the intent of being self-sustaining, to cover statutory requirements and meet the fund balance policies of the department. Pursuant to statute, excess revenues in one program can be used to support activities of another program. Revenues in excess of authorized expenditures, transfers, and cash balance needs are transferred to the general fund. The projected amount of such surplus funds for the 03-05 biennium is $3.9 million. Our bank and credit union programs operate under formal working agreements with federal regulators, which serve to reduce regulatory burden, promote supervision efficiencies, and minimize our costs. Our focus is on the safety and soundness of our state-chartered banks and credit unions and maintaining public confidence in the safety of their assets. Our securities program activities are defined in part by the extent of federal preemption, which defines stakeholder participation. By federal preemption, I'm referring to federal legislation that preempts or supersedes existing state laws. The primary focus of our non-deposit programs is consumer protection, as mandated largely by state laws. Some of our performance accomplishments over the past year include charters for new banks located in Newport and Beaverton were granted, approval for the conversion of a federal thrift charter to a state bank charter was granted for Liberty Bank in Eugene, I would add that we have two additional banks based in Albany and Portland that are on track to open in 2003. Also, I would add that our banking section was reaccredited for another 5 years in 2002 by the Conference of State Banking Supervisors, which is a nationwide trade association. The banking section was initially accredited back in 1992. The first new state credit union charter in over 20 years was granted to Hacienda Community Credit Union in August. Hacienda will focus its financial services on the nearly 120,000 Latino residents of Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. In the consumer finance area, in collaboration with sister states and the Attorney General's office, we participated in reaching a consent judgment with Household International, Inc. that will provide up to $484 million for the settling states. Oregon's share will be approximately $8 million. That will be administered by a third party to provide restitution to borrowers in a yet-to-be-determined manner and cover administrative costs. In the securities area, we participated with 48 other states in the Merrill Lynch Research and Analyst Settlement. A negotiated administrative order provided Oregon with payments totaling approximately $570,000. State and federal securities regulators have also announced a tentative $1.5 billion settlement with 10 of the largest brokerage firms on Wall Street. The initial draft of the proposed settlement agreement suggests that Oregon will receive $4.5 million in payments, and if that happens, that's transferred to the general fund. Locally, the division successfully investigated and aided in the prosecution of four people who masterminded a pyramid scheme involving approximately 1,500 investors and over $5 million in funds. In November, the four were convicted of various crimes involving securities fraud and racketeering, and a lead defendant has begun serving a 42-month jail sentence. You can find additional performance accomplishments on page 3 of our supporting material. We did have a budget note. The department was directed to evaluate pawnbroker regulatory program activities against statutory requirements and to evaluate the cost of operating the program at a minimal level. The director reviewed the level of regulation and reduced the number of FTE from 0.6 to 0.2, or 66%. This reduction was accomplished by changing the annual on-site examination to a biennial on-site examination. The staff will conduct the required annual examination on off years by requesting documents required to be examined by the law to be mailed to the office. So this change reduced travel expenses by 50% in addition to reducing FTE. Our $10.9 million budget request reflects no new positions, no new policy packages, but continuation of program activities that have been successful in the past, with an increased focus on performance measures, program review, customer service, e-government, and leveraging technology where possible. I would add on an administrative note, we continue to assimilate a complete new executive management team in the division, and we have several managers eligible to retire, so management succession remains a priority. What do these funds provide for? It will provide for oversight of over $32 billion in credit union banks, trusts, and savings and loan assets, regulatory oversight of 2,700 non-depository licensees. These are people who finance your home, sell your funeral services and merchandise, and collect overdue debt. It also will provide for the regulation of 112,000 securities licensing transactions, including 84,000 securities salespeople associated with 2,670 broker-dealer or investment advisor firms. Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer your questions or provide additional information as needed.
Well, you must have done a good job.
Yes.
What kind of materials do you provide for the general public, if any?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes. We have two programs that are designed to provide direct consumer outreach. We have an investor education program under the Securities Department, where we have one employee who participates in fairs, at fairs around the state and at schools. And then this year, we also hired a consumer affairs specialist for our non-deposit area, who is working, he is bilingual, by the way, he is working in the area of addressing predatory lending in the state.
I guess I was interested in the level of fees that you're getting. Do you have a list of the fees that you charge? You're smiling.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it's extensive. I mean, we have so many different programs. Yes, I, if you'd like a detailed list, we can have that generated for you. And some of the industries are charged fees. Others are charged assessments like the banks and the credit unions. It's based on total assets of those institutions. But, yes, we can get you a complete list.
Do you adjust those fees to cover your costs like other divisions do? So that if your costs go down, do the fees go down, or does it, the extra go into the general fund? Where does your money go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, Greg Malocasian again, and I'm finding that document that we provided you yesterday on the financial report is something that I'm referring to a lot because it is very similar. We have a department-wide policy on fund balance, and that policy is directed, obviously, by statute first. If there's a legislatively mandated requirement for an ending fund balance, that is what drives that policy. If we don't have specific legislative direction, that policy is developed and it's based upon some standards that include assuring that there's adequate fund balance, that fund balance does not create a need to have increased fees or that in great amounts to the stakeholders or those people that we regulate. So that there's some evenness in the fee rate. But almost all the fees that we collect go to the direct cost of providing the program, the regulatory program, and as Floyd indicated, in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a significant amount of the revenue received in the securities area does flow through, and that's a specific to the general fund, and that's a specifically statutory requirement.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions? Well, we have a very busy day tomorrow, and I want to thank everyone who's helped us today to understand this. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5011, and we'll see everyone first thing in the morning.
Thank you very much.